Good morning, I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Earlier this month, the U.S. eased travel restrictions to Cuba. Former diplomat, now human rights advocate, Anne Wright is heading there. We'll talk with her this morning. And 29 years ago today, the space shuttle Challenger exploded. Japanese astronaut Koichi Wakata is in Hawaii marking that event and talking to kids. He'll look at the current attitude towards science in the space program later this hour. On Wednesday, January 28th, this is The Conversation.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Bethke's new car, the current Manoa Valley Theater production, looks at the comedy and some of the sadness of midlife. We'll talk with cast member Dwight Martin. And a young car choreographer crafts a piece about the life she has chosen. Conversation starts right after the news.
We can see your head bouncing along, just like everybody else in the studio. Good morning. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich, and welcome to The Conversation. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Beth Ann. We often find ourselves wondering how people feel about science these days for a variety of reasons.
Science, yeah, and also about space, you know. Orion is up there, and there's so many things that have been going on of late that seem to be changing how we view and certainly how kids are viewing space again, or maybe not. We're going to find out this morning. Because you know that in the 1960s, space travel was on the minds of many a kid. The cascade of Apollo missions, the money poured into America's space program, and the attitude towards science fueled the dreams of would-be astronauts. That included a small Japanese boy. Koichi Wakata grew up to realize that dream. He's logged a full year in space, or just about a full year in space, over a 20-year career. And on the anniversary of the Challenger explosion, he's in Hawaii and with us this morning. Thank you so much for being here. It's really lovely to have you.
My pleasure, Bethan. Thank you.
When you were little, this was a very big deal. I mean, as a little boy in the 60s and looking up and wondering what if. You've been here in Hawaii now since, over the weekend and in Hilo to be able to talk to the kids for Science Day over there and back to the Challenger Center on Oahu. As you talk to kids, are they still in that same kind of wonderment?
I think so. I saw their shining eyes when they're listening to our stories of space exploration, and that pretty much reminds me when I was 5 years old. That's when I saw the Apollo 11 lunar landing as a small boy. I thought at the time only American astronauts and the Russian cosmonauts were flying in space. As a small boy in Japan, I thought it was beyond my reach. But thanks to the great international cooperation and NASA's leadership in training international astronauts in Houston, I'm here with you. So I think going to space really interests a lot of people. And then I was so happy to convey this excitement with the kids in Hilo.
After the Apollo missions, we saw sort of the interest wane a bit, and certainly the money going into NASA and a space program. Then it's generally, sort of we watch it come back a little bit. How do you peg where it is now in terms of interest, money flowing into the program, and what we might see in the future, given just some of the missions we've just seen fairly recently, including Orion?
Yeah, Orion was a very big success. The test flight in December, EFT-1, went really successfully. And we are flying space station, and right now we have two Americans flying on board the station. We're conducting a variety of experiments that will benefit, not only the Americans, but the entire world in medicine and engineering and materials. So we are gaining a lot of good thing from going to space and conducting experiments in space. And at the same time, going to somewhere we have never been, like to Mars, that really attracts a lot of people. And that's why we had a lot of interest when we flew Orion test vehicle about a month ago.
You talk about doing experiments in space. For a lot of people wondering, well, why space? Is it because it's so remote and in some ways some people might think relatively safe, or are there other benefits that we don't realize about how it's important to do certain experiments in space?
We have been doing a lot of experiments in space, and most of those experiments are utilizing what we call microgravity. You know, on orbit, everything floats. Using that environment, we are testing like a new technology to develop a new medicine, for example, medication to cope with different types or different strains of, for example, like influenza and muscle dystrophy or Alzheimer's disease. And utilizing or crystal growth in the microgravity will give us more insight into the development of this medication. So those are the technologies that we can benefit on the ground, not only in space. Of course, we are testing, gaining a lot of medical data so that we can send humans safely to space low beyond the low Earth orbit, like, for example, to Mars.
You talk about technology. When you first started your career, a lot of the social media that we now take for granted wasn't even thought of yet. And even in the last several years, the development of what you've had access to on a regular basis has greatly changed from your last mission to one even just a couple of years ago.
Exactly. 6 years ago, when I flew on the space station for about 4.5 months, we didn't have internet access. And we took a lot of pictures and we sent them down, and so the ground folks can distribute the images. But now we have internet access. When I flew last year on the station for about 6 months, almost every day I took pictures and I tweeted it. So it's amazing that we can share the excitement instantly from space, and a lot of, you know, retweets and replies. And so this social media's power is outstanding to convey the excitement in real time.
When you talk to students, not necessarily little kids, but students who perhaps want to make a career similar to yours, does the fact that you're able to give them such instantaneous information, you know, for them to know somebody up there is tweeting this right now, this is happening in real time, does that put a different spin on how we regard our place in space?
Yeah, I think so. The social media gives us like sensation that the space is like a tangible. It's closer to us, and because by knowing what's really happening right now, I think you can learn, you know, a lot of things that is happening in space, you know, right at the moment. So I think especially young people are really benefiting from this social media's interaction of our activities.
Is that changing the way that we generally look at science?
Definitely, it's probably gives broader or easier, faster access to the knowledge that everybody will benefit in searching for the unknowns in science. But I think general attitude or general, I don't know, spirit of searching for the unknowns, looking for something that we don't know, I think it's the fundamental desire of human beings and science has not been changed, in my opinion.
As you look at your career now, what else do you want to do?
That's a good question. And space is huge, and there are so many unknowns that we haven't seen yet. And by exploring the frontiers in space, we can gain new knowledge and technologies that humankind all benefit. The space program has become an international cooperation that spans around the globe. And whenever we different countries work together on the same goal, we encounter different challenges based on the different context, cultural context. But the outcome is always like pooling of visions to enhance our human society in a very peaceful manner. So I hope to continue on this human space exploration so that we can not only gain new knowledge to enhance our life on the ground, but also enhance the peaceful international cooperation.
So do you want to be up there or down here, or don't you have a choice anymore?
Well, I'd love to, you know, go back in a heartbeat anytime. The space is a wonderful place to work, but of course, you know, lying on the beach in Hawaii will be really nice. We took a lot of pictures of Hawaii. We have really good cameras on board the space station. This HD visions is amazing. Sometimes you can take pictures that looks better than the views that you see with your naked eyes.
Well, some might say that that's what happens when you're up in space, too. You get a whole different perspective that the rest of us just can't possibly understand. Thanks so much for helping us understand a little bit about your life, your career,
Thank you.
And how you see the space program developing with some of the kids that you've been talking to in Hawaii this week. Thanks so much for being here.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Koichi Wakata is a Japanese engineer and JAXA astronaut. He's a veteran of four NASA space shuttle missions, a Russian Soyuz mission, and a long-duration stay on the International Space Station. Over his nearly two-decade career, he became the first Japanese commander of the International Space Station. He is in Hawaii this week.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. It's 8:14. Later in the show, a comedy with a heart about the joys and sorrows of midlife. But first, your quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, we're thinking about one of Honolulu's first modern office buildings. It opened in 1907 in downtown Honolulu at 925 Bethel Street. So if you're downtown, no fair going outside and looking at it. It was made of blue stone and is considered a fine example of the Beaux-Arts architectural style that was popular in America at the end of the 19th century. The building's first story features a wide arcade overhang. The entryway is decorated with tile and marble. It even has a functioning basement, which was an unusual feature for that time, especially in that part of town. It was originally planned as a two-story building, but the plans changed in the middle of construction and made the structure rise to four stories. A fifth story was added in 1914, but it was built in a different and very incongruous-looking architectural style. The imposing structure still stands in downtown Honolulu, and today we're looking for its name. So, do you know? If you do, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689, and we'll see who gets it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Salt at Our Kaka'ako, a restaurant and retail destination opening in late 2015. OurKaka'ako.com.
Ricky got a new car.
There comes a point in many lives, usually just about halfway, when the grandiose dreams of youth have to be tempered with a dose of reality. Some of us find ourselves at midlife locked into a life that's defined by the many compromises we've made along the way. It can become a sad subject, or it can take you to the place where you just have to laugh. The play Becky's New Car, now running at Manoa Valley Theater, chooses the path of comedy. Dwight Martin plays Walter in the production, and he joins us this morning.
Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Dwight. Is this sort of a, I guess, is this a bittersweet play? How does it straddle the comedy sadness line?
Well, it's very interesting because it's very contemporary, and it invites the audience to come into the story at the outset and to almost be an additional character.
Mm-hmm.
And all of us, I guess, have hopes and dreams, some of which we have attained and some of which still elude us.
Yeah.
And we always are questioning as we go through life, I guess, did I take the right path? Should I have gone in a different direction? Or, in the case of this play, where an opportunity poses itself that was previously unforeseen, do you act upon that? And that really is the situation that is posed to the character named Becky Foster. She's in a sort of a ho-hum relationship. She sees herself as not doing anything particularly unique, and is sort of in a middle-aged wallow. And she meets a gentleman who suddenly offers an opportunity for a much different kind of life. So does she step out of her own and seek something new, or does she reevaluate the opportunity that she already has? And it's told with a lot of comedy, but also a lot of heart and drama. It's a very interesting contemporary mix.
I would think just about anybody would find something to relate to in this story. Who hasn't had some disappointments, right?
I think they would. And what's particularly interesting, Stephen Dietz, the playwright, writes with quite a contemporary voice. And so just about the time we start getting quite heavy and serious and on, you know, the precipice of, you know, life-making decisions, He interjects something that's just nonsensical and crazy, and everyone gets a quick emotional release laugh.
Mm-hmm.
And so it doesn't go over the edge by any means. He goes down it's almost like he's going down the highway, bouncing off the curb on both sides.
Right.
One is drama, one is comedy. Just about the time you get to the edge of the road and you think, oh, I'm going to go off, he swings it right back. And so it's very refreshing. And it keeps the audience actively engaged to the very end.
Well, what you said, I like that term, an emotional release laugh, because it might be something that wouldn't necessarily have been a laugh had not there been some sadness before it. Yeah,
true, very true. And it's interesting because the audiences have been responding extremely favorably. They've really been enjoying it, which is a lot of fun, and. It's just refreshing, you know. It respects your intelligence. There's a lot of the story that actually takes place off stage, and so the scene work that you see done on the stage is the reaction to events which have taken place.
Talking then, about just something just happened, and now we're
right,
we're
which
right
allows
to the reaction.
Audience member then to fill in all the details in their mind's eye. You didn't have to be there, but you can imagine what it must have been like. And so it's always moving forward quickly. And it keeps the story moving right along and keeps it fresh and fun to the very end.
Well, that's can be, you know, if that works, that's a very courageous thing for a playwright to do, right? Move defining action off stage.
It is. Yes. Yes, but, and you know, they say in acting that acting really is reacting.
Yeah.
It's not so much what you do as an actor, it's how your character responds to what another character has done. And that's kind of the way I think this play is constructed. You know, we are seeing the responses, and we are allowed as an audience to respond ourselves. And there is a lot of comedy in it, so it really is laugh out loud funny in many, many places. And it may sound like it's a woman's story because it's about a middle-aged woman, but not at all, because her family unit is herself, her husband, a 26-year-old son who hasn't yet moved out of the basement. Mm-hmm. And every character is three-dimensional. Every character has a backstory and an interesting life under themselves. And when they all merge together into this particular story, it makes it very bountiful. It's a lot of fun. It really is a lot of fun.
Your character is the agent of change, right? He brings about the possibility.
He does. He does. Quite by chance, his name is Walter, and quite by chance, Walter meets Becky when he has a need to buy some cars, and she works at a car dealership, and they meet quite by chance after hours, and he is a widower. And misunderstands that she's a widow, which is not the case. But through that misunderstanding, he very quickly takes a liking to her and becomes a bit infatuated with her. And so he has hope that she might fill a void in his life left from the death of his wife several years earlier. And believe it or not, there's a lot of comedy in that because, of course, the audience knows that Becky is still very much married and has a family. And so she starts leading kind of a dual identity. And will she cross that line far enough to be committed to Walter and staying with him and having a very different kind of life, a moneyed and society-based life?
Yeah.
Or does she stay with her blue-collar good man who provides for her kind of husband and the family unit that they have?
The comfortable familiar versus the unknown.
Right.
Exciting, but still
and
unknown.
And you can see where that's titillating. You know, you can see where she would be tempted. It's interesting because we've been getting live reactions from the audience where you can just feel their energy and you can hear through their responses whether that there are those who are in support of Becky going out
right.
and taking this whole new leap and so forth. And there are others who are like, no. You know, there's a point where the character of Becky and Walter kiss, and each night that earns an audible reaction, and you can tell in that reaction from the audience that there are different points of view being expressed.
Which team they're on.
Yeah, it's really quite interesting.
That sounds like a lot of fun, Dwight. Thanks
it
very
is.
Much for coming.
We have just five more performances, and we'd love to have people come see it because we're very proud of it. It's a lot of fun. We guarantee we'll entertain you, and it'll be thought-provoking, too.
We'll send people your way.
Good,
Dwight Martin plays Walter in the current Mono Valley Theater production of Becky's New Car, which runs through Sunday, and you can find out more on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Obama's State of the Union.
With a growing economy, shrinking deficits, bustling industry, booming energy production, we have risen from recession freer to write our own future than any other nation on earth.
The State of the Union in solid policy, laugh lines, and teary moments. Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
Through their generous donations, our nearly 12,000 members across the state make it possible for HPR to give voice to the many communities that make up our island home. Mahalo to Kauai residents and station members Edward Lanson of Kapa'a, Scott Fiorovich of Kilauea, and Walter and Ann Barnes of Kapa'a. They rely on KHPR and KIPL for their news, talk, and entertainment. And if you also come to HPR for the diverse perspective shared here, show your support at hawaiipublicradio.org or call us at 808-955-8821 during business hours. And thanks.
Support for The Conversation comes from PBS Hawaii. Next on Hiki No, Roosevelt students share their thoughts on Governor Ige's vision for public education. 7:30 tomorrow night on PBS Hawaii.
Where did you come from, my darling?
The band, the David Wax Museum, is adapting to life on the road with a baby.
And so I picked up my bow and started in on this encore song. And little Calliope was maybe 7 months, just reached her little hand up and grabbed the bow.
Balancing babies and work, I'm Sarah McConnell. Join me for With Good Reason, Thursdays at 6:30 on Hawaii Public Radio.
Many people want to come to Hawaii hoping to retire here. Some even come here for careers, but when the time comes to retire, can they afford it? Many who hope to stay in Hawaii after retirement are now finding they just can't do that. Chad Blair has more in today's Reality Check. Hi, Chad.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Looking at the idea of retirement, for a lot of people for whom that may be off in the future sometime, and they're in a career here now. That's one thing. And if you grow up here and if you've had family here for a while, that's another thing. But for people who look at Hawaii as being the ideal spot to retire, it's pretty tough when they realize that maybe they just can't. That seems to be a big part of this story.
Right. And Eric Pape opens his latest stories on our Living Hawaii series, profiling a couple, the Keeners. They've been working for the Air Force and then later civilian work. Well, guess what? They're going to retire in March, but they're not going to stay here. They'd like to, but their life savings are just not enough to retire here. One statistic alone, $700,000 is the median price for a home. Instead, they're going to South Carolina, where they can get a really nice large house for $180,000.
That's a huge difference, and that means much more is going to go into the bank and maybe into a couple of vacations to Hawaii, because they still have kids here, right?
That's exactly right. So how ironic. You're moving away from Hawaii because you can't afford it, but you're going to save enough money that you're going to be able to visit.
Well, on one hand, though, you know, for some people who are lucky enough to be able to do that and have family still here, that's a possibility. But for people who look at Hawaii as being the ideal place to come, they get a pretty rude awakening if they haven't done a lot of their homework.
They really do. And the statistics are pretty sobering. When you factor in the cost of living, we're the fifth worst state for retirement. Honolulu is 104th. In cities, which is where you would like to retire. Ironically, something that I would have never figured out, Kailua has ranked among the top 10 places for wealthy retirees.
Right. And you just sort of went to some of the new information that's been coming out from Wallet Hub as they've been looking at the best places to retire. Hard to swallow that one, but certainly it's no big surprise that it costs a lot of money. And as people age, they're going to need more services and more affordable housing.
It's those services in particular that are as a concern to AARP Hawaii. In-home health aid care, about $58,000 a year, that's going to cost you. And if you need private nursing care, a whopping $135,000 a year. Who can afford that?
Very few people, which means to say maybe Hawaii is a good place to work, but maybe you just can't retire here. Who knows? When the time comes, Chad, you and I will see if we have family here who will take us in. All right. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Bethann.
Chad Blair reports on politics for CivilBeat.com.
Tonight at 5, it's Bite Marks Cafe with Bert Lum and Ryan Ozawa. Bert's on the line and to talk about the acronym HURL. This is my favorite so far.
You know, that's actually one of our favorites also.
Yeah.
It stands for Hawaii Undersea Research Laboratory. And what these folks over at the University of Hawaii do is control a fleet of submersibles that are, for the most part, going deep into the sea and exploring areas that we would normally, you know, not get access to. And, you know, it's a very interesting program. And you know, they've actually done some pretty interesting discoveries. So we'll talk a little bit about their discoveries. But the also, you know, interesting challenge for them is how do they continue to sustain this program? And evidently, you know, this program is under threat of not having enough funding to keep going.
That would be a shame, Bert, because that's where the really exciting discoveries are being made, in the
deep,
deep trenches.
Well, and you would think
trenches,
that in Hawaii, being that we're in the middle of the ocean, that a lot of research activity would take place in the ocean, and, you know, with a facility like this and the capabilities and the expertise, that it would be highly sought after. So we'll kind of talk to them about, you know, how the program developed, what people were actually looking for when they funded the project, and how did that sustain them over the course of time, and what is it that they need to do to keep sort of that interest going forward in the future.
Well, Bert, if they got video of a giant squid, that would get them a bunch of publicity all at once.
Yeah, I think they did get some interesting sea creatures, so that in and of itself is fascinating.
There's some amazing ones down there. Thanks a lot, Bert.
Sure thing.
That's Bite Marks Cafe tonight at 5 p.m.
Support for The Conversation comes from Sacred Hearts Academy, an all-girls school for preschool through high school, announcing the spring open house Sunday, February 22nd at 2:30. Learn more at sacredhearts.org.
It was just about 2 weeks ago that the U.S. lifted travel and trade restrictions to Cuba. And while you can't quite go there on vacation just yet, some people are making their way to Cuba, and that would include Ann Wright. The retired Army Reserve colonel, career diplomat, and Hawaii resident is now known for her activism since her resignation from the State Department in 2003 over the war in Iraq. She has traveled extensively, protested when she thought it was necessary, and even been arrested a time or two. Today she starts a trip that will take her to Cuba, and first she joins us by phone. Good morning.
Hi, Beth Ann.
Are you all packed and ready to go?
Oh, well, you know, it's a crisis on the day that you leave, so I'm flurrying around here trying to get everything done.
All right. Well, thanks very much for making some time for us. You've been in some pretty volatile places. I'm thinking about Gaza and Nicaragua and Somalia and a whole host of other we don't have time to name. But how does that, you know, square up with some of the dangers that you've been facing as an activist?
Well, here in the United States, sometimes you get roughed up a little bit by the police when you're out doing your civic duty and challenging policies that you think the government is incorrect on. One of the things I've been working on is the issue of police brutality. I was in Ferguson, Missouri in November for the weekend of resistance there, and then I, with Code Pink Women for Peace, helped sponsor 9 mothers whose sons had been killed in police brutality, unarmed civilian youth that had been killed by police. So those are some of the issues that we all face in our lives as citizens of our country, and when we compare it with what's going on in the rest of the world, it's not like America is the most peaceful place in the world either.
So, Ann Wright, with all of what you've just said and the fact that not everybody can just get on a plane and go to Cuba, how are you going to Cuba?
Well, you know, it's always been possible to go. You've had to go either under a U.S. Treasury Department license, which has allowed tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Americans to go down there. It's a little bit of a complicated process. Or you could go individually by going through Canada or Cuba, and not under a license, but risking the wrath of the U.S. government for going to a place that our government doesn't want us to go.
Not like you haven't done that one before.
Well, you know, it's you know, the land of freedom, of everything, of expression, of whatever, right to travel, and here our own country sometimes limits what we can do for political reasons because they don't want to have any money supporting a regime that they characterize as, you know, whatever the characterization it is. And yet when you travel to these countries, you find that perhaps there's a little bit different story that's going on that our own media and our own government isn't telling us about.
You mentioned that people have always, or some people, some being the operative word, have always been able to go to Cuba. There are, what, 12 designations of folks who can go to Cuba if you're an academic or you have a specific reason for being there that you can justify, or you have family there perhaps. How are they letting you in?
Well, this time, because we're taking 150 people, it's a very, very large delegation and the largest since the opening up of diplomatic relations, although that's still ongoing, but it's the largest one since Obama announced that the U.S. government would be lifting sanctions and allowing greater travel. And we are going under a license that Global Exchange, which is a group that has taken thousands of people to Cuba. I've gone under different circumstances, though. Back in 2006, we took 15 people to go to Guantanamo to have a protest out of the back gate of the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo. And that way, we went under a caveat that was there that if you go to a conference that's sponsored by a third country, not Cuba, not the United States, but a third country, and so I think it was the Organization for the Global South out of Bangkok, Thailand, sponsored our vigil and protest at the back gates of Guantanamo.
So, I mean, that one had a very specific purpose that wasn't necessarily welcomed by the American government. But now you're going back with a very, very different focus. What is it that you hope to gain with all of those people, those 150 people who are going with you?
Well, it's an opportunity for those who have never been to Cuba to see what's going on there, the good and the not so good. There's plenty of remarkable things that have happened in Cuba that we can learn from. I mean, when all of a sudden a big neighbor cuts off all ties, all economic connections, puts an economic blockade on you, then you're forced to be very self-reliant. And some of the self-reliant techniques that Cuban agriculture, organic agriculture, permaculture, all sorts of things that the Cuban people have developed. Also, we'll be taking people to see environmentally sensitive areas that the Cubans have preserved. We'll be going to their medical school, which actually trains American students. Over 100 a year graduate from a renowned medical school that is given to them free. Their only caveat that the Cuban government says is that they want these Americans to go back to underserved areas in the United States. We'll also be talking with Cuban doctors who are some of the very first medical people to arrive in the Ebola countries of Sierra Leone, Guinea, and Liberia. They quickly augmented the Doctors Without Borders permanent staff that are in those countries and beat all the rest of the international community by a month and a half in getting professionals, medical professionals there to help the people in West Africa.
I mean, clearly there's a lot that has been going on and coming out of Cuba that we don't really know as well as perhaps we should, which after you're there for a while, you're going to make sure we do.
I certainly will. And, there's some very serious aspects of this. And certainly the human rights record on certain issues of the Cuban government is not stellar, as our human rights record on certain areas is not stellar. We will be looking at the serious things and the wonderful things. For example, the music, the art, the culture, going to wonderful museums and it'll be a wide-ranging trip to expose 150 people to as much of Cuban society as we possibly can.
You probably made a lot of people want to go with you. Have a good and safe trip, and we'll talk to you when you get back.
I thank you much, Beth Ann.
Thanks so much for joining us this morning. Ann Wright is a retired Army Reserve colonel with nearly 30 years in the military. She was a career diplomat posted to some of the most dangerous places over the globe. In March 2003, she resigned from the State Department on the eve of the war in Iraq. Since then, she's been a traveling activist, filmmaker, and co-author of the book Dissent, Voices of Conscience. And as you heard, today she heads to Cuba.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Straub Clinic and Hospital, a proud healthcare partner of University of Hawaii Athletics. Learn more at straubhealth.org.
In today's backyard quiz, we thought about a building in downtown Honolulu that you may well have noticed if you're in that part of town for its distinctive architecture. It's at 925 Bethel Street, kitty corner from the Richard Street Post Office, within view of Iolani Palace. It's five stories tall, and if the fifth story looks tacked on, That's because it was. The bottom four stories were built in a Beaux-Arts design in 1907. The top floor, of a different color and a different architectural style, was added 7 years later. Its owners were three brothers who made their fortune drilling artesian wells throughout the Hawaiian Islands. They were also part of the so-called Committee of Safety that helped bring about the overthrow of the Hawaiian monarchy in 1893. The name is also the name of the building we asked you to tell us about this morning. It was McCandless, and their memory is kept alive by the McCandless Building. It is 8:47, and that's today's quiz. If you have one for us, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. When you commit to a life in the performing arts, you set out on a journey, one that offers plenty of promise but also has its pitfalls. Dancers have a kind of full-body commitment because their art calls on every muscle to work in sync with the mind and spirit. It's a tall order, and it's the subject of Rocky Takaesu's dance recital, which is part of the UH Dance Department's Winter Footholds Concert. She's with us this morning to talk about The Journey. And The Journey is an apt title for your show because, in a way, you are the subject of your presentation, yeah?
Yes, yes. It represents all of our different journeys, I guess you could say, through dance. And the show's title is called Echo, and I guess you could say that kind of means to us how dance resonates with all of us in our lives and our own separate journeys, so...
Because you're part of a show with several other dancers and choreographers,
yes.
Right? But the journey, specifically your segment, is about choices you've made in your life, right?
Yes, that's correct. It's based off of how I pictured dance to be in college and how it started and I guess how I believe it to be now as I'm finishing my last semester.
When did it start for you? How old were you when you knew dance was going to be it?
Well, I started dance much earlier before I realized that I would want to pursue it. I started dancing hula actually at the age of 4.
Mm-hmm.
And then I branched off into other dances when I was, I guess, upper elementary, you could say. And it wasn't until my junior year of high school that I finally realized that it was something that I wanted to really pursue. So that at that time, I was getting ready to go to college and figure out really what I wanted to get into. And when dance, I guess I, when I realized dance was something that I wanted to do, it was a really big changeover. I'm switching gears.
Did you have, you know, mentors you could talk to about the kind of commitment that you were making at that time?
Yes, actually. I had a couple of people who are really influential in my choosing dance, and those were my dance teachers at the time.
Mm-hmm.
They both pursued it in different ways, but they each had a lot of insight to what the options were and what I could eventually do. So they were really, really big parts in me choosing it.
Is it important when you're thinking about a path like this to kind of confront the possibility that there could be some big disappointments ahead?
Oh, yes. It's, I guess it's a every, not every day thing that you feel, but after every audition or every chance that you get to be in a part, be in a dance, you realize, oh, it could not work out necessarily. And some things could, I guess you could say, go wrong and not go in your favor, but you have to just overcome that really as a dancer to make yourself grow a lot more.
Does it help to look at the stories of people who have gone before and hear them tell you, yeah, well, I had my share of setbacks early on?
Oh, it does. That's, I guess you could say that when dancers ask other dancers questions,
mm-hmm.
that's something that they respond to. They really look into, oh, okay, what did you do to get here? And the dancers' responses are usually, oh, well, I didn't get this role, and I didn't get this role, but I kept persevering, and I was focused, and I kept going, and despite all of those setbacks, that they ended up where they are at that moment, and they share that with us, and it's really nice to see that happen.
It's a world, the dance world is sometimes one you hear of as being really competitive, because there are obviously not as many places as there are people who want to be in those places. So have you found that to be true? Or
yes, I have found that to be very true. I think that a lot, there are so many dancers, so many people who want to have dance as a career and as something that they can fully make a living off of. But that struggling artist cliche kind of saying is true in some aspects, that it's difficult to pursue this art form because everyone doesn't support the arts in the same way that we do. And making a decent living is difficult pursuing dance.
How have you dealt with that so far?
So far, I guess I have just been more optimistic about it. I am preparing myself for the setbacks, but also looking to grow. And once, I guess, you set your heart in dance, you realize that growing is one of the only options that you have. Mm-hmm. So to really figure out that instead of getting that role all the time or being in that company, it's more of a journey for yourself. Having you grow is more of the perspective rather than being the best all of the time. Just because once you stop learning, especially in dance, you set yourself back a little bit, and fully growing and thinking that you can always be better is something that I think all dancers should have.
Because you hear of, you know, great dancers, you know, the Baryshnikovs and Margot Fonteins of the world, taking class every day, mm-hmm. throughout their lives. You know, probably Baryshnikov to this day, he's in his 60s. Is that your level of commitment?
Yes, I want to say yes at this point. I would love to take class every day. It's not always an opportunity that I know that I have. But
it's kind of important to keep that as...
It is very important to always practice your craft and get better, because practice makes perfect. To practice every day and to rehearse every day is crucial, crucial.
Well, you know, because I think you've hit on something, Roxy, in terms of saying... Rather than worrying about getting the part, worrying it if you're growing, I think you might, if you continue to focus on whether or not you're growing, that's a really good path. That's a good alternative, don't you think?
Yes, yes, definitely.
Well, so far so good, right?
So far, yes, so good.
And this is kind of a milestone for you, the performance that begins tonight, right?
Yes, tonight, and it runs all the way through Sunday.
Well, it's great to talk to you, Roxy, mm-hmm. and good luck with it.
Thank you so much.
Kind of a major step forward. Good talking to you. Roxy Takaesu's senior project, The Journey, is one of the featured dances in ECHO, the University of Hawaii at Manoa Department of Theater and Dance's Winter Foothold Series, which showcases new choreography by graduate and undergraduate dance students. It's at the Earl Ernst Lab Theater, runs through February 2nd, and more than 40 student dancers, choreographers, technicians, and designers are part of it. You can learn about it on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Support for today's programming comes from the Masters of Public Administration program at UH Manoa, featuring evening classes for working professionals, now accepting applications. Learn more at puba.hawaii.edu.
Searching the web for what's on the next Radio Lab. As we interact more and more with machines, what are these relationships telling us about ourselves? It's nice of you to ask. I've wondered that myself. Of course it matters.
You are so special.
Send me your credit card info.
Here's the contact information.
Hear Radiolab Saturday morning at 10.
Wow, from Siri to her.
Yes, exactly.
Now maybe we won't have to fight if we can get some better voices on our iPhones and other phones and tablets. Anyway, you were listening pretty intently when we were talking to Anne Wright about her forthcoming trip to Cuba. She's leaving today.
One of the most striking things about Castro's incredible longevity running that country is the very clever, his very clever PR, including exporting doctors to all parts of the world. As you heard, they were some of the first on the scene to treat Ebola. That's a very smart sort of medical diplomacy, and it's spread a lot of goodwill for his country.
And we'll see what happens after we know much more about that country, now that it's a little more open to a lot of people, and 150 people going with Anne Wright starting today. We'll follow up with that and give you some more. But tomorrow, we're going to talk about the protection of digital assets and some related legislation. Our very own Ryan Ozawa will be with us.
And there's a weekend Makahiki celebration and master guitarist Carlos Barbosa Lima performing live in our studio.
If you've got a conversation we should hear, you can tell us on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, on Twitter at HI Conversation, or at BKOZHPR. If you like email, we got that too. It's talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Hear today's show again, get another past show or links to more information on the HPR2 website, hpr2.org. I'm Chris Vanderkamp.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you tomorrow morning for more of The Conversation.